talk about what happens in the HBPS sector and the role played by matrix models and collective field theory. And then we will go into the research that I'm currently doing with a lot of people in trying to push ADS-CFT beyond the HBPS sector, so going to a supersymmetry that is not just HBPS, but quarter BPS and 8 BPS. And if I have time, I will talk a little bit about some ideas that I have about future work that are trying to put in some time dependence or some dynamics. But if this takes me too long, I will skip this. So the basic feature of ADS-CFT is that it's a correspondence between a theory of gravity that lives in a certain number of dimensions and a field theory that's conformal that lives on the boundary of that gravitational theory. And because this field theory lives on the boundary, which is one lower dimension with respect to the theory of gravity, the duality is often called holographic. And in particular, it tells you that you can relate string theory on a certain background, which is ADS5 times the sphere, to a gauge theory that lives in 4 dimensions. And it has 4 supersymmetries, and it's called n=4 super Young-Mills. And the correspondence is between certain fields that live in gravity and operators that live in the conformal field theory. And one of the most important features of the duality is that it is a strong, weak coupling duality. So notice that the appropriate coupling parameter in the gauge theory is a combination of the Young-Mills parameter and n, where n is the rank of the group, or alternatively is the number of d-brains that you have. And this is called the Atuft coupling. So this is the appropriate quantity to look at if you're looking at the gauge theory. And that's related to the string coupling and the radius of ADS. So this constant r just tells you the size of your anti-de-Sitter space. And the Young-Mills side, so the gauge theory side, has a perturbative expansion when the coupling is small. So when the Stuft coupling is much less than 1, you can do perturbation theory and you can trust your results. On the other hand, gravity, the classical description or the supergravity description, is reliable when the radius of curvature is much greater than 1. So you can trust the supergravity approximation and you don't have to worry about string corrections. So if you compare these two, you see that these are opposite limits. So when you can do perturbation theory, so when lambda is small, the supergravity approximation will break down and vice versa. So this is useful because by studying the weak coupling limit of one theory, you can learn about the strong coupling limit of the other. But it's also one of the major difficulties in proving ADS-CFT, because you don't have a well-defined perturbative description at the same time on both sides. So it makes proving the conjecture very difficult. So we said that there's a dictionary between some field theory and theory of gravity. And the reason, well, there are several reasons why that's true, but you can get a feeling for why it happens by comparing some of the features of the two theories. So for example, ADS, anti-de-Sitter space, can be thought of as an hyperboloid embedded in one higher dimension. And you can parametrize it by using these coordinates, and it takes this form. And you can see that the symmetry of this, the isometry of this object, is SO2, D. The reason, the easy way to see that is by noticing that you can rotate these two, that gives you the SO2, and you can also rotate this D coordinates, and that gives you the SOD. At the same time, SO2, D is a symmetry group of, it's a D-dimensional conformal group. So this tells you that this theory of gravity has something to do with a conformal group. Another feature that they have in common is if instead of looking at ADS, you look at the sphere, and you, again, think of a sphere as some surface embedded in higher dimensions. If it's a 5-dimensional sphere, then it will have an SO6 isometry. Well, there is a corresponding SO6 symmetry in the gauge theory side, which is a symmetry that, roughly speaking, is rotating six scalar fields that are inside of this Young-Mills theory. So you see that there are common features. And if you're not that familiar with ADS, I just wanted to give you a simple example. So if you look at three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space in a certain set of coordinates, it looks like this, where this coordinate theta is playing the role of a radial direction. Time flows this way, and then you have an additional angle right here. So when people talk about the boundary of ADS in this type of coordinates, that corresponds to this pi over 2, the angle pi over 2, which is the equator of the sphere. So the boundary of ADS would correspond to this. So this is just to give you a flavor of what ADS looks like in a certain set of coordinates. A nicer way, I think, to think of ADS is this picture. And a lot of people apparently use this, so I'm not the only one. So think of anti-de-Sitter as being some ball. It's full of material, full of stuff, and the inside has some hyperbolic geometry. The boundary of ADS is the boundary of this bubble, and the interior is often called the bulk. So throughout the talk, you can just try to remember this picture. So anytime I talk about the boundary, I talk about something that lives on the surface of this ball. So at the beginning of ADS-CFT, it was a duality that was established only on supergravity. So it was a classical duality. The first step, so there were no strings in the picture. The first step to trying to extend it to string theory was done by Berenstein, Maldacena, and Nastase in 2002. And they extended it to string theory in a very specific background. It's called the plane wave background. And the reason why that background is so special and so nice is because you can solve string theory exactly on it. So it's not flat space. It's a little bit more sophisticated than flat space, but you can still solve the theory exactly. And you can do that because the string action becomes quadratic, so in the light cone gauge. So it's very simple. It becomes quadratic and you quantize it. So what they found is that string theory on this particular background corresponded to a certain sector of the conformal field theory. And that sector is just a large R charge sector, but this is just a technical detail that you don't need to worry about. So to give you a feeling of what plane wave background is, you can start from ADS 5 plus 5. So this is ADS 5, where you have some radial coordinate rho, time, and then some sphere, and this is a five-dimensional sphere. And you can focus on the geometry that would be seen by a particle that's moving very rapidly, rotating very rapidly along one of the angles, and it's sitting near the origin of ADS-5. So think of this as being ADS-5. This is the sphere that's crossed with it. And you want to focus on a region that's very close to the origin. And you can do that from the metric in a systematic way by introducing light cone coordinates, rescaling some of your variables, and taking the large R limit. You see that when R becomes very large, this coordinate rho becomes very small, which means you're going towards the center of ADS. And also theta is becoming small. So you're just zooming into the region that's near the origin. And it's not flat space. It's a little bit away from flat space, but there's some curvature. And then you get a metric that's a plane wave metric. So if you've seen it before, that will ring a bell. Otherwise, it doesn't really matter. So the main result of this work was that they were able to match the spectrum of strings to the conformal dimensions of the operators in the field theory. So they basically matched masses of strings. So this was very nice. But they did not do it for interactions. So they only studied the spectrum, no interactions. So what happens if you look at interactions? So imagine that you have some simple model for a scalar field with some cubic interaction. This doesn't have to be realistic. It's just a simple model. in the original formulation of ADS-CFT, there was a prescription to compare correlation functions in the field theory to interactions in ADS. And that prescription can be explained by a simple diagram, where here I'm calculating a correlation function in field theory, so this is just a standard three-point function. And on the other side, I'm looking at interactions of three fields, 1, 2, and 3, in ADS, and I'm putting the fields on the boundary. So if you remember my picture of ADS as a ball, with the boundary as being along the edge, the fields 1, 2, and 3 are sitting on the boundary, and then I'm relating them to the center of ADS. So these straight lines are just propagators, and they happen to take this type of form. They're called bulk to boundary propagators because they take you from the inside to the boundary of ADS. And then you find that this correlation function in the field theory is given by some integral over these propagators. So this is a gravity calculation and this is a field theory calculation, and they match. So lambda is just a coupling, and the integral is over the inside of entire zero space. So you're integrating over everything, but you're placing your three fields at the boundary. And the results agree, and this is the dictionary that was used to study interactions. But what about interactions inside of ADS? And by inside, I mean I want my three fields to be in the bulk, not anymore on the boundary. What do you do when you don't have a boundary anymore? How can you calculate this and compare it to the gauge theory side? So of course you know how to do the calculation in gravity. We can do that. But the question is, what dictionary am I going to use to match that calculation to a gauge theory calculation? So if you remember, as an example, the plane wave geometry that I showed you before, you were zooming in the center of ADS, but if you live here, if your fields only live here, you can't access this boundary. So in this particular limit, the boundary of ADS was lost, and so you can't use this prescription anymore. So even though there should be a dictionary, so there should be a way to compare these gravity calculations to the field theory calculations, this prescription that was given may not be the right one. So it looks like this prescription may not be fundamental, and it's not complete. So even if... Let's go ahead.
When you're talking about the gravity calculation here, you mean a field theory calculation in a fixed background?
Yes, I mean just a supergravity calculation over
supergravity
fields.
Okay, but so you're treating the fields, you're treating the non-gravitational fields as quantum and the gravitation and the metric as classical?
Yeah, I'm doing fluctuations on top of ADS5. That's
okay.
So I'm just starting small fluctuations on top of ADS5.
Okay.
Is there any way of understanding that you're doing those two calculations that you compared on the previous slide? Are they done in any sense in the two different limits that, you know, where the two theories were perturbative? Or is this something that doesn't rely on any way?
Yes, I think they are done in the two different limits in the sense that you do the calculation where you can do it. So the supergravity calculation is done in supergravity.
It's done in the perturbative limit of supergravity.
That's right.
And the other one is done in the perturbative limit of the other theory.
Yes. But then you compare them.
Then you compare. I see. Okay.
That's right.
So that's what you meant by that calculation.
That's
comparison.
Right. Yeah.
So that's not a... Is that a proof that they would match everywhere for all values of the couplings?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would expect corrections. But you would assume... Well, if ADS-CFT is really a correspondence and not just a conjecture, then they would have to match.
Right, that's why I asked.
But then you have to start showing it little by little. And so this was step number one.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm.
So far...
Have people gone beyond that step number one?
Well, I'm going to talk about it.
I see. Okay.
So that's part of my work is going that direction. But for the masses, for the spectrum, they did show that the string theory calculation matches the field theory calculation.
Right.
But that was just a spectrum, so just masses.
Right.
So you calculate mass of a string, and then you compare it to the conformal dimension of an operator and they match and you're happy.
Yeah.
But for interactions it's more difficult. Okay, so I guess part of my work is to directly try to construct the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian that would be general, and once you have a Hamiltonian, of course you understand, you know what the theory is. So instead of relying on this prescription, which seems to be breaking down, you try to construct a Hamiltonian. Okay, so what you have seen so far is that if you really want to understand ADS-CFT, then you need a very precise dictionary that relates the two sides of the conjecture. And in the original ADS-CFT, in the sense of what I told you about so far, you had a correspondence between perturbations or fluctuations in ADS and the field theory side. But we should be asking if we can go beyond the perturbative description. And so you might think that good candidates for dual states in the field theory might be supergravity solutions that are asymptotically ADS5 plus S5. So not only perturbations on top of this, but really solutions, full solutions that are asymptotically this. And then the real hope is that you can extend ADS-CFT to the entire BPS sector of the two theories. So not just the most simple supersymmetry limit, but more general, the full spectrum. So the first step in this direction was done 2 years and a half ago by Maldacena, Lin, and Lunin. And Lin is now a postdoc in Michigan with me, and I'm working with him. And they were able to develop this dictionary for the entire half-BPS sector. So not just perturbations, but the entire half-BPS states. So keep in mind that I want to go back to the problem with studying interactions. And the natural question for that would be to find the right Hamiltonian. So along the way, I will show you how to get the Hamiltonian for the half-BPS states of the theory, and then try to get that Hamiltonian for geometries that are more general, so they don't have the maximum amount of supersymmetry, they have less supersymmetry, and this is work in progress.
What does half-BPS mean exactly?
It means that these states preserve half of the supersymmetries. So their mass equals their charge, but they only preserve half of their supersymmetry. So if you start with a given number of supersymmetries, let's say 16, they preserve 8, and then the quarter BPS would be 4,
right.
So on. Yes, so sorry, I should explain that. Okay, so what are these half-BPS geometries in this type of string theory? So this paper was remarkable because they managed to construct exact solutions to 10-dimensional supergravity that happened to have half of the supersymmetries. Not only they constructed all of the solutions that have the symmetries, but then they show that they're related to the sector of the gauge theory that has the same amount of symmetry. And on top of that, that sector happens to be described by fermions, free fermions. So they did two things, found new solutions and then matched them to the gauge theory.
So the upper construction is done in the ADS.
Yeah, so this is just a gravity construction. You take 10-dimensional supergravity and you find solutions.
But in the background of the
No.
No?
Their solutions are very general. Some of them are asymptotically ADS5 plus S5. Some of them are not. So this is the most general.
But is it the asymptotically ADS5 that are supposed to be matched to the free fermion picture, or every one of the states? I thought
every one of them.
I think your original statement was it's showing you the ones that were asymptotically ADS.
Well, you might think that those would be the most useful in terms of ADS-CFT because so far we understand ADS-5 plus S5 and CFT. But what they did was find solutions that are very general. The only constraint that they have is that they have this much supersymmetry.
I see.
And
so it's that full set that is needed to match the other.
Yes, that full set happens to be this. That's right.
Free fermions in how many dimensions?
In two.
In two dimensions?
Yes.
Okay.
So I will explain that in detail.
Okay.
Okay.
And should I understand these half BPS solutions in the bulk as being genuine string theory solutions,
or just supergravity?
So the ADS-CFT correspondence then isn't supposed to be exact, is it? Because it's supposed to be exact for the full string theory.
Right. So this is, okay, so this is pushing it, it's still supergravity, but you're going beyond small perturbations.
Right.
So these
okay.
are not just fluctuations on top of ADS,
right.
they're new solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still supergravity.
But without the...
Without string theory.
The string connection, the corrections.
That's right.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so the solutions that they got were all regular, so they're not singular, they don't have any singularities, and they happen to have this type of isometry. This simply means that there are two three-dimensional spheres inside of the geometry. So this is an S3 and this is another S3. And then these geometries all correspond to certain states in the gauge theory side, and those are called chiral primaries. And the states are known to correspond to droplets of fermions. And I will show you exactly why this is true in the next few slides.
Will you explain what a fermionic droplet is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I will. Well, you can think of it as just a drop, some bubble made of fermions. Okay, so they found geometries that have various shapes, and I will explain to you exactly what this picture means, but for now, just think of these as different droplets, and each droplet corresponds to a different geometry. And you can think of them as being filled with fermions. So think of the dark regions as being particles, and the non-dark regions as being holes in the condensed matter language. And the nice thing about all this is that you have a correspondence between these shapes and the geometry. So the general idea that they used is that they started from a 10-dimensional background of this form. So you have a sphere, 3-dimensional sphere here, another one here, and then some 4-dimensional piece there. Because of these two spheres, you could say that this part of the metric is pretty much constrained. You know what it looks like. So you really have four dimensions that matter, in the sense that you don't know anything about this, but you know something about those two. Then if you want time translation to be a symmetry, if you want to have a time-like Killing vector, you kick out one of those four dimensions, and then you're left with three dimensions that are really important, really non-trivial. And so it turns out that all these solutions can be described in terms of a single function, z, and that single function depends on these three non-trivial dimensions. And notice that y, if you look at the radius of this three sphere, the radius of that, y is basically the product of the two radii. And this will become important later. But if you multiply this radius by that radius, you get y squared. So think of y as the product of the two radii. So they found an equation for this function z.
So the x1 and x2 are, of course, two of those.
Oh yes, they are
inside
this.
Why
is
outside? Why don't 3 and 4 matter?
Sorry?
Why not 3 and what happened to x3 and x4? They aren't crucial in some sense?
Yeah, in some sense they're not crucial, because if you start from 10 dimensions,
mm-hmm.
these two spheres are sort of trivial because you know they're there, so they're not. You put them in by hand in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then that leaves you with four dimensions.
Right.
And time is one of those four.
Mm-hmm.
So we're left with three.
But why
so
is
y
one
is
of the x's?
Yes, yeah, sorry. Y is inside of these.
So
okay, good.
Oh,
yeah.
X1,
X2, and Y are the three spatial dimensions.
Yes.
Okay. Kind of
yeah, I should have
okay.
put that. So
mm-hmm.
here you have T, X1, X2, and Y.
All right, okay, now I understand. All right.
Okay. And so they found that this single function obeys some simple linear equation, relatively simple. And if you want the solutions to be non-singular, you find out that z on the y equals 0 plane can only take these two values. So z can be plus 1 half or minus 1 half on this y equals 0 plane, but nothing else. If it's anything else, then the solutions will be singular. Now, this has a meaning in terms of what happens to this metric. And this tells you that only if you want your solution to be regular, these two spheres cannot shrink to 0 at the same time on this plane. So only one of them is allowed to shrink to 0, and it has to shrink smoothly. So if you want this metric to be non-singular, you want only one of these three spheres to go to 0 on this special plane. So that's the meaning of that boundary condition. So again, if you know that your boundary condition is that z can only take two values on a certain plane, you could give one color, say black, to one of those two values, white to the other one, and in this way you color code your solutions. So this special plane where y is equal to 0 is a plane where you can draw shapes or droplets and you can color code them. So wherever the droplet is black, z will be, say, 1 half, wherever it's white, it will be minus 1 half. And the shape of the droplet will be your boundary condition for your function z. So this is just a Green's function statement. Your z, the full function, is determined by the boundary condition and the value of z on the plane. So z on the plane can only be plus or minus 1 half, and the shape of the droplet comes in as a boundary condition instead of the integral. So this is important. So if I'm not clear, stop me and ask me.
What other boundary conditions are on Z? Because if it's a linear differential equation, there's nothing special about plus or minus 1/2. Because it can multiply
through
that
constant. Okay, good. So the plus or minus 1/2 corresponds to either one of these three spheres going to 0.
Okay.
So plus 1/2 means that one of them will go to 0 on this plane, and minus 1/2 means that the other one will go to 0. If they both shrink at the same time, your solution will turn out to be singular.
Singular in the four
in the
10-dimensional.
Ten dimensional.
Okay.
Yeah, so you want to keep these 10-dimensional geometries to be non-singular. And so you can't have too many things in the metric going to 0. Because you know that if they go to 0, you get a singularity.
I guess Damien is asking the question, the differential equation doesn't look like it cares about the magnitude of the
singularity. No, but if you find the Ricci curvature, if you find out what R is, you'll see that if you want your solution to be non-singular, you need those two values.
So for the full 10-dimensional
solution. That's why you asked your question.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I see.
That's right.
Now
so the yes. So.
But on the field theory side, does the 1/2 have a meaning? Because the fact you're calling these fermions and the numbers 1/2 just seems sort of.
No, it doesn't. You could call it 0 and 1. It's just
okay.
Turns out to be 1/2. But it matters that it's one or the other. So it's either a particle or a whole. It's not. You only have two choices, but that matters. Okay, so again, you can draw a shape. That shape specifies your geometry through this boundary condition. Because
so
once you have the z, you know what the entire solution looks like.
So the integral there is really over the whole plane. It's just that it's with a plus sign in some areas and a minus sign in others, right?
Yes, this integral is over the entire plane.
Okay.
Can see right here. Yeah. So this, I think, is the most confusing part of this work. So it's good that you asked me all the questions. Now, you can imagine drawing any shape here. Not only that, but this is a linear equation, so you know that sums of if you sum different z's, they still obey the equation. So this is what we mean when we call it bubbling. So we have all this rich moduli space of solutions that all have this amount of supersymmetry, and they're all parametrized by these fermions. So I would like to show you why there's a fermion description.
Do we just go back?
In Y space, these things look like some kind of tubes of different color or something like that, that you keep propagating from this surface.
They don't have to be tubes. They
well,
could be
okay.
anything. It's just that the two-dimensional slice looks like
well,
that.
Well, you know, they're tubes. In a certain sense, they're probably whatever. Tubes apart from that modulation, but that one over... By that Y square in the denominator. And that out front thing, right? I mean, but it's, they all look the same in a certain sense.
I wouldn't think that they would look the same. Maybe I'm missing one. I would think that they could... No, they wouldn't look the same. It's just that... When you slice...
If Z is only plus or minus 1 there.
Right. Yes.
Well, I'm a little bit
but then the shape is what really matters.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's that that confuses. If you say that... You said you could superimpose two different
well,
solutions.
If Z1 is a solution and Z2 is a solution, the sum of them is also a solution.
But they would have different black
yes,
and
that's
regions.
Right. Yeah.
And so at the overlap regions, there would be... Z would take two different values, and that doesn't screw up the 10-dimensional.
In the overlap, if you start overlapping them, I didn't think about overlapping them.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's a if they were overlapping, whether that would screw up this.
I don't think it would.
Regularity.
I don't think it would, but I would have to think about.
Well, I think because it's linear, it probably wouldn't. It would be. I think it sort of looks like mountain peaks spiking off into the. Y direction where the mountains can be touching or not in some sense. But
it's gone.
I've seen too many.
Since I don't understand this 10-dimensional regularity, I'm not going to understand your statement.
Okay.
But
well,
anyway, it's a question.
Yeah.
But let forget about overlapping for a second.
Yeah.
If you draw, let me get to this picture, okay? If you draw, let's say that you only draw this. That is a solution. So this
yes.
thing corresponds to some geometry.
Mm-hmm.
This is also separately a solution.
Right.
But the sum of them is also a solution.
Yeah, that I can...
So yeah. By overlapping, you mean two black regions on top of each other?
That, well...
Yeah.
So if these are really
well,
fermions, I can't do that, right?
Well, okay. If you could definitely put black on top of white, right? So you could certainly fill in that hole
yes.
with a black region. That
mm-hmm.
wouldn't cause any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Putting
right.
two blacks on top of each other, I haven't thought about. I would need to
yeah.
think about
that. That would change your. You couldn't then even normalize it back to z equals plus or minus a half.
Yeah, that,
probably.
See, that's what bothers
yeah.
me. Yeah,
yeah.
right. Yes.
But what doesn't that correspond on the other side to two fermions sitting on top of each other?
Yeah, but you wouldn't.
Which you
that.
Can't have.
I mean,
so it's not.
Enough.
Yeah, so this may be where this fermionic word comes in, is that you're not allowed
yeah.
to do what I just
you,
said.
Yes.
I don't know.
But that okay. But do you understand the rest of the idea? So you
yeah.
If you make it 0 and 1, then it's easier to see what a superposition
okay,
is.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
So there is some actually right. That's the missing piece of information. There's some constraint on this. Superposition coming from this normalization of disease that has to
yeah.
be sort of something to be
okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. Okay.
So you can't pile it up. They can touch, but you can't pile it up.
Right.
Probably
mm-hmm.
not, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So soon it will become clear why you can identify with this plane with fermions. But first, notice that if I draw any shape that corresponds to some geometry, and it turns out that this, the most symmetric, the simplest one, corresponds to ADS phi cross phi. So this is really the ground state of your theory.
Is there a scale in here somewhere? How big is the black area and the white area?
Oh God, let's see. If you make it bigger...
Do I think of this as on a Riemann sphere or something?
No, I think you would be changing the flux if you make the size bigger. I think that's
mm-hmm.
the only...
So that's like the curvature radius of ADS?
Yeah, I mean, you're... Yes, but... So changing the size doesn't really matter that much.
Okay.
So relative sizes, of course, matter. I mean, if you put... It matters whether you put another big circle here as opposed to a tiny circle. But
mm-hmm.
just making this larger shouldn't really do much. I think it will change the flux.
Okay.
So this configuration... Oh, by the way, if I just put little ripples here, like those would be small perturbations. So those would be your fluctuations, just quantum field theory fluctuations on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you put a tiny circle outside, that corresponds to what's called a giant graviton. And that's just the D3 brain that's rotating very quickly, wrapped around the sphere. It doesn't really matter. The point is, it's a more complicated geometry that you cannot describe as a small perturbation on top of this. And then you can do things that are even more general, more complicated. The plane wave background that I told you about comes from, it has this shape, and it basically corresponds to zooming in on a tiny piece of the circle. But it looks like this plane. So why, how can you see that there are fermions? So let's, first of all, remember what BPS means. It means that the mass is equal to the charge. In this case, this is the energy of the solution is equal to the angular momentum. And so the paper by LLM calculated the energy of all the solutions. So this is a gravity calculation, and they found this type of expression where this thing is usually defined is equal to n, is equal to the flux. And if you're familiar with matrix models, you will immediately recognize that this is the energy of fermions or a matrix model with a harmonic oscillator potential. If you're not familiar, it doesn't matter because I will explain it to you in gory detail. And I will also explain to you that matrix models can be described by a field theory that's called collective field theory. Now, why are these half BPS states as opposed to something else? And why can you use only one matrix for this type of states? Well, imagine starting from two matrices. So take X1 and X2 to be matrices. You get some Hamiltonian where these are just conjugate momenta. And then you have some angular momentum that takes this form. And I'm going to rewrite these two expressions by doing some linear combinations of my fields and my momenta. It doesn't really matter what form they take, but I'm introducing complex matrices and conjugate momenta.
Let's see, where are the matrices? I don't know anything
so,
about matrices.
Okay, so think of X1 and X2 as matrices.
Okay.
So everything here is a matrix.
All right.
And then you can build other matrices out of them. These are just linear combinations. Z's and these guys are just linear combinations.
So I shouldn't think of these as coordinate and momentum yet or anything like
well,
that.
Not yet. They would be if they were not matrices.
Yeah.
Right. So you can think of it as coordinate and momentum. It's just that these are matrices that represent coordinates and momentum.
Okay.
Now, if you introduce some other linear combinations of them, your energy and your angular momentum start looking like this. So here I'm just rewriting what H and J are. So now you can construct states the way you do it in quantum mechanics. So you act on the vacuum with creation annihilation operators. Well, creation operators. And if you construct a state that is made only out of A daggers, you will see that the energy is equal to the angular momentum. But as soon as you put in the other creation operator, B dagger, you see that E is not equal to J anymore. So if you have both A and B or only B, these guys are not BPS because their energy is not equal to their angular momentum. So if you want to have the half BPS sector, you want to keep only A oscillators. So you kick out the B's. And since in this sense, A is a single matrix, it happens to be complex, but it's just one. And so you can describe all the states using just one matrix. And in the gauge theory language, as I told you at the beginning, you have some scalar fields in super young Mills. They're called phis. You have six of them. But if you only pick two out of the six, you can construct some complex quantity that's a matrix. And these half BPS states correspond to this type of operators. And these are called chiral primaries. The key feature is that we have only one matrix, only Z.
But it's not actually a matrix in this theory.
Well, if you go back to where it came from, it was a linear combination of the X's.
But in the other theory, 5, 5, and 5, 6.
Right, now here
fields.
You would need to think of these as your x's.
They are. This is an SUN. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. So those are.
I see. I think in terms of the. Okay.
So think of these as your axes, and you're building some matrix out of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you only have two, and so you only have one matrix.
Yeah. This is five dimensional super young mills, right?
Four.
Okay. Right. Okay. So there is still some ADS CFT correspondence left. There is still some four-dimensional thing here, even though it isn't necessarily the boundary of the the geometry.
Right.
Okay.
So what's happening is before, when you didn't have this the entire happy PS sector, but you only had small perturbations, you were only looking at operators that had only, say, this piece. So trace of just one power of z. But now that you're looking at all these states, you get traces of several powers. And that's the difference in the gauge theory side. So your operators are becoming more complicated. So before you could only do this, just one of them, but now you can do many. But because they're half BPS, this is only one, it's the same Z. You will see that if you introduce, if you lower the supersymmetry, you'll start having different Zs built out of the other fields. But that's more, that's not needed. Okay. So, it turns out that if you have one matrix, you can describe its eigenvalues, which you can think of as fermions, so that's where the fermions come from, they're just eigenvalues, using a theory that's called collective field theory. And so this shows you that this fermion description is starting to emerge. So what is collective field theory? Well, you can start from a simple matrix model. So again, M is a matrix. It depends only on one coordinate, let's say time. And this is its kinetic, this is like x dot squared, and this is x squared. So this is a matrix in a harmonic oscillator potential. If you diagonalize it, you get eigenvalues that still depend only on time. And these guys are what you can think of as fermions. So it's a one-dimensional theory so far. But I can introduce a new coordinate x if I come up with a field that is basically picking up the eigenvalues of the matrix. So now, instead of only having time, I have time and x, where x is basically related to the eigenvalues. And if you take the number of eigenvalues to be very large, x is becoming it's really a continuous coordinate. So when n is large, you see that you have a new dimension appearing. It's a spatial dimension. And that's why some people say that gravity is emerging. It's emerging because it's really a trick. You're trading eigenvalues for a coordinate. And with this trick, you're getting a new dimensions. Now, if you just rewrite this Lagrangian in terms of this field, and then you find a Hamiltonian, you get this very complicated, well, kind of complicated Hamiltonian. And what it looks like, it doesn't really matter. And one of the main people who worked on this was my advisor, Yevitsky, and then Shumitas. The normalization is a technical detail. So this is the type of Hamiltonian that we found. You can now introduce linear combinations of phi and pi. If you do that, the Hamiltonian takes a simpler form. So notice that this was an integral over only one dimension. Now I have an integral over two dimensions, but you can check that these two are really the same thing. And why is this important? Well, if you go back and look at the Hamiltonian, so the energy and the angular momentum of all those gravity solutions that I told you that LLM found, you'll see they have a form that's very similar to this. It's not just similar, it's identical, because this x1 squared plus x2 squared is the same as alpha squared plus x squared if you rename objects. x1 and x2 become x and alpha. And you can check that the other term also matches. So you can see that all these half BPS states that were found on the geometry side are described by this type of theory. So, did I lose anybody? Any questions?
So there's a cubic, there are cubic terms in the upper line there.
Right.
And so let's see what you introduce. Oh, I see.
If you do the integral, you get a cubic.
If you do the integral, I see.
So it's
okay,
a
now I understand.
It's a trick.
All right.
Okay, so now we learned that if I want to study FPPS states, I should look at this Hamiltonian. Okay, now remember that I'm really interested in interactions, so I'm going to go back to the interacting piece of the Hamiltonian. I'm going to study fluctuations on top of the background. So eta is just a fluctuation. And if I can, you know, I can change my coordinates, in my Hamiltonian will look like this. If you notice, this is pi squared eta squared, so this is just some kinetic term, and this is my interaction. So eta cubed, pi eta pi, so it's a cubic term. So I'm going to look at this and concentrate on it. And if you can, if you do some manipulations to your fluctuations, alpha, remember I introduced alpha in the previous slide, it's just a fluctuation. It turns out that you can rewrite in a very simple form. And if you evaluate the integral, you get this answer.
Is this exact or is it to? No, it's not to first order negative. This is an exact expression. It's not obvious that it has a ground state, is it?
Oh, the ground
because
state.
Because it's a qubit time derivative.
Right, right. But the ground state is static.
Okay.
So it has a ground state.
Okay.
So let's see, before you had this integral over d alpha and.
Okay, let me go back to that.
Let's see, I'm trying to get this step.
Yeah, so I had this integral over.
Okay, so now alpha is going to be mapped into some kind of time?
No, so alpha is a fluctuation. So what I'm doing is, okay, so my fluctuation, think of alpha and eta as being more or less the same thing, they're just fluctuations.
Okay.
What is going to be traded for time is the x coordinate. And it's not really time, but it's called time of flight.
Mm-hmm.
It's just trading x for a new coordinate. And so this is your, you're still integrating over x, basically.
Right.
This is your fluctuation.
But you're no longer integrating over them in that expression.
Oh, that's right. Yes. So I went back to the original form of the Hamiltonian where it was only one integral.
Oh, I see. So that's why I see the cubic things.
Right.
Back
yes.
Here. Okay.
Yeah.
No,
the cubic term is back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the problem with this is that sometimes it's most more useful to look at one as opposed to the other one.
Okay.
Okay. But the bottom line is that after you're done with the integral, your cubic interaction looks like this. And of course you have to tell it what phi zero is, the background, but that comes from solving, finding the static ground state. And once you know what phi zero is, you can do the integral and you get this thing. So the nice thing about this is...
What Siegel was talking about the ground state, I understand, so you have a solution which is static, but given you have a cubic perturbation, is it clear that it's not going, it's positive. In fact, if I look at the perturbative evaluation in this Hamiltonian, right? It sounds like it can actually produce states with a lower energy than the one that you started. So is there some way to show that it's not doing it, or?
Yeah, there is a way.
In other words, it sounds like there is at least a possibility for some kind of tachyon or some such thing.
Yeah, yeah, I think the reason why it's stable is because, so remember, this came from a harmonic oscillator potential.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that, and then you have this phi cube term, basically. It turns out that if you look at the full potential, there's actually, I think, a phi to the fourth.
I see. So this is really some kind of truncation of the theory.
Yeah, so perturbatively, we stop the phi cube.
So it's actually not the true ground state that you're starting with. You're starting around some.
I'm expanding around the.
Fair enough,
yeah. The static background.
Okay.
But I am
but
doing perturbation theory. Yeah.
Okay.
So there is a nice well-behaved term that keeps the phi cube from being a problem. It's just that it doesn't show.
So what are the ends here? I'm not too sure I understand exactly.
So the ends, what would
little end here.
Oh, okay. I'm just expanding my fluctuation in creation and annihilation operators. So I'm summing over all the quantum numbers. It's that, it's basically a harmonic oscillator. So I'm summing
right.
over the energy levels.
Oh, okay, that's the way I would think about it. Right.
So I'm quantizing my field.
Mm-hmm.
And once
okay.
I do that, so this was a field theory calculation. This is some field theory, but it happens to match precisely the calculation, the corresponding calculation on the gravity side. So this gets a little technical, so I don't need to explain everything, but if it turns out that you look at the right fields on the gravity side, these are chiral primaries, and this was worked on by Seiberg and other people a few years ago. They have a very nasty equation of motion with a bunch of ugly derivatives, but you can remove these derivative couplings by a field redefinition, and what you get is a much simpler equation of motion with a really bad coefficient. Okay, so I put this here just to show you that this is the fact that the collective field theory will agree with this is very nice. It's non-trivial. Okay, but now the coefficient is gone. And if you you actually know what the form of this field is for highest weight states, you can do that integral. Sorry, you can calculate the three-point function, and you will get this answer. Compare it to the collective field theory answer, and lambda is now n, you see that they are identical. The square root is this, this is that, except for this delta function, which is a slight technical detail which I can explain at the end of the talk, but I don't want to go into it now. So the collective field theory result is exactly the same as the gravity calculation, and it should be, because these are just basically happy PS states, and we know the collective field theory describes happy PS states.
So this is a gravity calculation on
ADS5 cross S5 reducing on the S5.
Okay. So what is it, a three-point function of? Three points in the interior of the ADS5, or where are the 3 points? Or is
if you want to think of it in that language, then they would have to be on the... Well, these are just three supergravity fields.
Right.
And you're finding their interaction. So this is the interaction of S and S, three supergravity fields. So you're integrating over the entire bulk, in a sense.
Okay.
Right? So this will be an integral over the entire ADS5.
Mm-hmm.
Where are the fields? Are they in the bulk or are they on the boundary?
I guess I would say they would have to be on the boundary if you want to use ADS-CFT. But this is a gravity calculation in the standard sense in which you integrate over all space over the three fields. So you don't really need to ask. I mean,
okay.
If you want to think of ADS-CFT, then I guess they would need to be on the boundary to compare to the CFT. But yes, they would be on the boundary.
Okay, now, but so you're doing the three-point function and integrating over
the entire ADS5.
ADS, and are the J's
angular momentum?
Angular. Okay.
Yeah. So this is basically angular momentum on the sphere.
Okay.
But then because these are also have BPS, so delta will equal J. Okay. So far we only saw FPPS states. We want to go beyond that sector. So you saw that you have this FPPS states, they're described by fermions and one matrix. So if you want to look at something more general, you will probably need more than one matrix. And studying states that correspond to two matrices or anything more than that is very difficult. So instead of using in some sense a brute force approach, we want to do something a little bit different, maybe find some trick that will help us. This is work that I'm doing with Yavitsky and Robert de Mello-Koch, which should come out soon. So we are interested in understanding interactions or states that are more general than one matrix states. We want to look at two matrices to begin with. So we will assume that the collective field theory vertex that I showed you before is still valid if you have more than one matrix. And then we will use the generators, raising, lowering generators of the theory, to generate interactions. And I will tell you what I mean by that. And by using these generators, we end up finding some identities that are very useful because they relate vertices that we already know, so vertices for one matrix, to vertices that we don't know. And this is a technical detail I want to skip. So as a Tolle model, imagine that you have a particle in two dimensions. So x and y are your two directions. You can find energy and angular momentum as we did before. You can construct states by acting with A dagger and B dagger on the vacuum. And then you should know that you can get to a given state by raising, with a raising operator, on a state that has a lower n. So this is just standard statement that if I act on something with L plus, I get something with a higher weight. So what we're doing is starting with some interaction that looks like this, where these are wave functions that correspond to two matrices. That's why they have two quantum numbers. And we're acting with generators, raising, lowering, and also L0. And by doing that, you can find some identity, and the form of this doesn't matter. But this is an identity that allows you to relate the states that we don't understand, that have two matrices, to states that correspond to only one matrix. And it's not obvious from this, but imagine looking at, let's see, if you set n to 0, so look at this, if you set n to 0, you're killing one of the two creation operators. So that corresponds to having only one, corresponds to having only one matrix state. So imagine setting these guys, these three n's to 0, that will correspond to something that we understand. L0 acting on those is something we understand because, as you may remember, L0 just gives you the energy. So these guys acting on one matrix states will give you something that we already know. And then you can relate that to states that have a different N1 and 2 and 3 by using these raising and lowering generators. So the trick, it's basically a trick to get some identity that uses the symmetries that's useful. So because I'm running late, I'm going to be very quick here. Instead of doing it for a Tolle model, we'll do it for a model that has two matrices. The wave functions for this type of model have been found by Donos, who's a student of Yavitsky and Rodriguez. So we can use those wave functions to find an analog of the identity that I just showed you, except that this time would be for this full model instead of the Tolle model. So we can use symmetries to try to better understand interactions. Now, remember that if you went from the matrix to this collective field, you picked up a new dimension x, it was really to the eigenvalues. If you add another matrix, that will allow you to probe yet another dimension. And so with the work of LLM, they were probing, it turns out, one of the angles of the S5. So we can say that if we introduce another matrix, we would like to probe maybe the radial direction of ADS5. So maybe we can try to explain the interactions that are inside of ADS in the bulk by probing the radius. We're not doing this yet. It's a little difficult, but this is the eventual, this is the goal. Try to understand things that depend on the radius inside by adding other matrices. So this is the end of the section on interactions. So Any questions on that? Okay. So the picture that we saw so far was only for states that have that had half or supersymmetries. We want to try to see if we can find a similar picture for states that have less supersymmetry. And this is work I'm doing with a bunch of people, including people in Michigan, Liu, Vaman, and Hailin. Donos was a Brown, and Chen, Wen, and Lin in Taiwan. A lot of people. So we want to try to extend ADS-CFT to the entire spectrum, not just half BPS, but lower supersymmetry. And we want to see if we have a similar picture of bubbling, so all this rich structure of solutions, if you lower the supersymmetry, and ask what happens on the gauge theory side. So people actually worked out the supergravity solutions for this type of geometries. So the quarter BPS were done by Donos very recently, and these were also done. So what is missing in these papers is the boundary conditions picture. The reason why it's missing is because the equations that they got for the geometry were so complicated that they couldn't do anything with them. They couldn't solve them. They couldn't get any physics out of them. So what we're trying to do with what I'm trying to do in this paper is understand the boundary conditions, and if we can develop some picture for bubbling in these cases when you don't have as much supersymmetry. So if you compare now the metrics, the exact forms don't matter, but this is the metric that was found for the half BPS solutions, and then you have quarter BPS and 8 BPS. The most important thing is that in this case you had 2-3 spheres, and so the important information was in here. Here you had one sphere that's an S3 and then a one-dimensional sphere, a circle. So the important information will be inside of these 6 dimensions. And here you have only one S3 and then 7 dimensions. So you can see as you lower the supersymmetry, more dimensions become important. And that's because you're fixing the geometry less and less. Now the boundary conditions in this case were on this special plane, X1, X2 plane. So you should expect that the boundary conditions in these two cases should be inside of this non-trivial 4 dimensions and here this non-trivial 6 dimensions. And that's because everything else in the geometry has been fixed. And we do find interesting boundary conditions in here. And they again correspond to how these spheres are shrinking smoothly to make sure that the entire 10-dimensional geometry is non-singular. So we have a very nice picture of what happens as you lower supersymmetry, but the equations are very complicated. So for example, the quarter BPS solutions, all these different metrics depend again only on one function z, but now this function has to obey a very complicated differential equation that's non-linear. So z is related to k, this is called the Kähler potential, and k obeys a very nasty nonlinear equation. So trying to solve it explicitly is very challenging. Finding explicit solutions by solving k is almost impossible for now, unless you make simplifying assumptions on k. So what we try to do is embed solutions that we know inside of this matrix, and then try to understand what that means for the boundary conditions.
Quick technical question.
Yeah.
In those, in that last set of equations, is the z that you're differentiating k with respect to the same as the z that's derivative?
No, sorry.
Okay.
These are complex coordinates.
Okay, good.
Sorry. Yeah, I didn't even see it. Same with it. Yeah. So these are combinations of the coordinates that you have. It's just bad notation. Okay. So what we are asking is if there's an analog of that special plane where the fermions lived, where you can define some nice regularity conditions so that you will know your solutions don't blow up. So you can do that, and we did it for several solutions that are known. We took this quarter BPS and 8 BPS geometries, we tried to put them in the languages, those very complicated general solutions I showed you before, and then get some feeling for what the corresponding boundary conditions are. And we also made some assumptions on K to try to find new solutions. So the picture that's emerging is that now you have, for the quarter BPS, instead of having two-dimensional plane with fermions, you find surfaces inside of four dimensions. So ADS5 crosses 5 now looks like a sphere embedded in four dimensions. You can look at some other two charge solutions that are smooth, and now they will look like an ellipsoid. And more complicated geometries will have more complicated shapes, presumably. And then for the APPS, it's the same story, except that now there are surfaces in six dimensions. And the nice thing is that the inside of these shapes is now empty. So there's nothing inside of them. While here they're all full, here they're all empty. So only the space outside is allowed.
Do you still have any kind of superposition here? Looks like things got very non-linear.
Yeah, we can't tell.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard to see. I think we can tell for the half PPS. So one thing we're doing is taking all the half PPS states and putting them in the 8 PPS.
Uh-huh.
And there you see that whatever superposition there was already, you will still recover it. But
in an obvious way?
No.
Okay. So it's
possible, I don't think anything
superposition,
is obvious anymore.
It's possible that a coordinate transformation or something might give you superposition back.
It's
some sort of.
Yeah, now everything is very obvious.
Okay.
Even embedding ADS 5 plus S5 was difficult. And that's the simplest solution we have. So. Okay, well, I ran over time. So. Questions are still open are whether you can draw any shape in these higher dimensional spaces and get a unique geometry, that's not clear. And then what's the gauge theory description? And how can this work be useful? It may look formal, but eventually we should be able to do something useful with this. So we're trying to understand what happens with the SFT when you lower supersymmetry. So first of all, you're getting more general geometries, and then you're seeing what happens on the gauge theory side with less SUSY. And eventually it would be nice to understand more realistic dualities starting from ADS-CFT, maybe DS-CFT, or maybe applications to QCD. And I'm interested in seeing if I can do something with time dependence, but so far I don't see good ways to do that. And there's also some black hole applications. It turns out that people use this for the half EPS case, they use the description in terms of fermions to show that you can understand a black hole in a quantum mechanical way by using the corresponding fermion description. And they show that the singularity that you seem to have in classical supergravity is not really a problem in the theory of fermions. It's just the fact it shows you that the classical description is breaking down. So people can repeat that now for quarter BPS and APPS, because there are black holes that are quarter BPS and APPS. I'm skipping future applications. So it's true that ADS-CFT is a conjecture, but in the past few years, there has been a lot of progress. So you should try to remember that. Although there are still problems, like that on interactions. Interactions seem to be particularly difficult. But now we have a very rich structure for half BPS solutions. We want to understand if that survives with less supersymmetry. And the lesson maybe that you should get as far as interactions is concerned is that we have symmetries, so we should try to use them to make the problem easier, since attacking multi-matrix states is impossible, or very difficult. Maybe we can try to find some tricks using symmetries. And then it would be nice to go beyond static solutions, see if we can do something with time dependence. Okay, thank you. No questions?
I have one more. For the half BPS solutions, what is known about how general this set is? Is this all possible stationary half BPS solutions, or is it just some large?
I think it's all possible ones. Yeah, so there was, yeah, I think so. I think the quarter BPS maybe is not as clear. At least there are several, you know, there are other constructions for the quarter BPS solutions that are different.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that there are different constructions. Whether they cover every possible solution, I don't think is clear yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, I mean, probably works, but it's not completely clear. And they don't just include things that are asymptotic to ADS 5 versus 5. They're more general than that. They have other backgrounds also. So in some sense, there's too much freedom. For example, those equations that I showed you, they all depend on the Cato potential. But for the 8 BPS case, there is even more freedom. So it's difficult to find explicit solutions because you don't have enough. Either the equations are too hard or you don't have enough conditions on them.
So what does this mean, though? So you have this matching for these half BPS solutions, but there are other solutions like the 1/8, the 1 whatever.
Well, you might ask, what happens if you lower supersymmetry? Do I lose all this nice correspondence with a gauge theory, or is it still there? Does it really depend on the supersymmetry? So that's what we're trying to answer. Can you still get a nice correspondence if you lower supersymmetry?
But also the question is, in what sense are the half BPS solutions a full set in this business? I mean, they're...
Oh, they're tiny.
They're just a tiny set of
solutions. You match those solutions to a certain kind of matrix model within the other context. And I guess to really prove the full conjecture, you have to run through all the possible solutions and find the matching in the
other. Right, but at
the
beginning,
the first
ADS CFT was just doing small fluctuations.
Right, I understand.
And
this
then
is
you
progress. I'm just trying to understand
how
far there is to go.
No, eventually, you have to go to non BPS solutions.
Yes,
okay.
Well, it's hard to. I mean, you have to do it little by little.
Yeah. Sure.
If you want to have your cosmology division or something, that would be or could be or possibly maybe instability that we were asking about earlier. Actually, maybe a way to think about it. Because maybe, you know, that state in the treatment of that cubic interaction. You had that state around which you were expanding, and it seemed there is some cubic interaction there, and there is no real instability in the sense that there are sort of quartic interactions. Frequently elsewhere, but the state around which you started, in fact, you know, doesn't want to stay time independent. It wants to change into something else.
Yeah.
With a cube under the influence of the cubic interaction.
You're thinking that might help you with the.
I don't even care whether it will help me with any realistic problem. It would be interesting to see what is the that will lead to presumably some time dependent solution.
Oh yeah.
And then it's an interesting
time,
thing.
No,
absolutely.
And I did.
No, what does cosmology look like in a matrix model?
Oh, but that people have worked on. That.
They have. Okay.
Yeah. The problem. See, when I.
I mean, you know, before you start learning how to break supersymmetry, it's probably difficult to hope that you're going to get some realistic cosmology out of it anyway. But
yeah, so
that doesn't mean you can't ask questions about.
No, you can, but you're not going to get a cosmology, and I can show you how. Let's look at simple half BPS fermions. Okay, this is ADS 5 plus 5. Now you could ask, what happens if I put a perturbation on top of this, and what happens if I make it time dependent? See, when I first started learning about this, I thought, well, if I make my perturbation, so here I'm making this radius fluctuate in time, I thought this might give me some time-dependent geometry on the other side. And then I thought about it a little more, and I realized that it's not going to give you time-dependent geometry. It would just give you perturbations on top of ADS 5 versus 5. There would still be small perturbations. So if you don't have time dependence, you still get small perturbations, you just get a smaller set. If you put time dependence, you get some more complicated time dependent perturbations. still a perturbation. If you really want something that's not a perturbation, a real time dependent geometry, I don't think you can do that with fermions. Well, not in this picture. Here, the collective field theory allows you to study fluctuations on top of a background. The fluctuations may be time dependent, but it's still fluctuations on top of a background. Now, in the world of the collective field theory, those will be, you can get time dependent backgrounds, but on the gravity side, they're just going to be small perturbations. So that might not be the best way. What I thought, another way that would be a little easier, is ask what happens if two bubbles meet and they form one. So obviously these are topology changing solutions, transitions. This should be a time dependent process. They're meeting, they're joining, they're forming another one. It should have something to do with time dependence. I'm not sure how to describe it. And the best thing I could come up with is something that already Shepard thought about, which is when they meet, let's say that they meet at a point, you can blow it up and the region will look like this. So you have, this is one bubble, this is the other bubble, they're meeting here. It turns out that this point is singular. So this is a transition, you have a singularity. So my best way to try to understand this process is try to explain what happens here. And my best guess is that you have, it turns out that you have giant gravitons, which is just D3 brains, and they're wrapping the two S3, those two spheres that I showed you right there. So I think that what's happening is that at this point, the giant gravitons are becoming very light, they're becoming massless. And so probably if you put those back in, you will see that the singularity is resolved. That's my guess. But this is not time dependence. I don't know what to do with these solutions on time dependence. They're all PPS, they don't want to decay. And the matrix model idea is a good one, it's just that people have worked on it and they can't get anything very interesting out of it. They get some time dependent backgrounds, but they're not that interesting. Kind of, they don't really have much part. They either don't have any particle production.
Is this recent Chicago / is that these matrix? Oh no, sorry, Berlin difference.
Those are not.
That's different.
That's not the same. Strominger and Kaczmarek.
Yeah, okay, right. Indeed, the fermion droplet universe. So.
Yeah.
That was a really good talk.
Oh, thanks.
This is stuff that I had heard vaguely about, but had never seen enough of the details. Now at least I know how to think about it.
Thank you.
I think you just have to be patient.
No, that's difficult for me.
So the one bit that made, this is probably just a slide.
Is that thing off?
No. Shutting down. I like to miss them.